It's a powerful scene, isn't it? Tremendous section of text in John chapter 9. The musical group R.E.M. sings a song entitled Everybody Hurts. And the lyrics include a refrain that rings true for every person who's ever been born. Everybody cries and everybody hurts sometimes. Suffering can evade us for seasons in our life, but sooner or later, everybody hurts. We find assurance in the fact that we're not alone in our tears and pain, and yet more often than not, we are haunted by the questions that germinate in our sadness. Why me? Why is God allowing this in my life? Why do I suffer? We search for answers and causes to our journey's seemingly random unfolding. Most of the time, we're left unsatisfied. As we come now to the healing of the blind man in John 9, the topic of suffering is embedded in the story and bubbles to the surface. Jesus takes the occasion of an offhand question by the disciples about suffering to broadcast critical spiritual truth. We learn some things about suffering in this text, and we also learn a great deal more. In John chapter 8, Jesus declared himself to be the light of the world. And this statement was followed by a very lengthy dialogue that Jesus had with the Jews, and that dialogue ended with attempted murder. Now in chapter 9, John, this masterful preacher and teacher, weaves into his gospel a story that illustrates what it means for Jesus to be the light of the world. It gives us a portrait of what happens when the light shines. In the end, the blind man will end up seeing, and the religious leaders do not. It's a lengthy story. Sorry to cut the video in the middle of the story. But we're going to take 2 weeks to look at this miracle and what follows after this miracle. This week we're going to focus more on the suffering and the healing, and next week focus more on the spiritual implications. The text reads, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? And Jesus answered, it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. So the story begins with a transition. As he went along, as he passed by. The second half of chapter 10 is connected to the Feast of Dedication. And that occurs some 3 months after the Feast of Tabernacles, which is the context for chapters 7 and 8. So apparently this healing took place sometime in between these two festivals. The important thing, however, is the theological principle, not the chronological issue. We learn initially that the man is blind from birth. Later we find out that the man is a beggar, which means that he cannot support himself by any other means. We assume that the man is an outcast. He lives on the fringes of society. His life has been marked with suffering, and he has no supportive community. The man's condition points to the fact that human beings are spiritually blind from birth. And that's true for every one of us, isn't it? We come into this world blind, even if we have eyes to see physical things. We're separated from God. We can't see spiritual realities. Church going and Sabbath keeping cannot heal this blindness. It takes an act of God. The disciples asked Jesus the million-dollar question. Who sinned, this man or his parents? The thought that suffering is the direct result of sin was a common view. Remember, that was the perspective of Job's friends who pleaded with Job over and over and over again to confess his sin and to repent from his sin so that he would no longer be laden with these physical afflictions. The rabbis also held this view, and perhaps it was based on Ezekiel chapter 18. What we read there in verse 20, that the person who sins will die. The son will not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity, nor will the father bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. And it seems the disciples concurred with this view. The only question to them was, well, who had done the sinning? The man or his parents? You know, it's kind of hard to imagine that the man's sin had caused his blindness because he was born blind. There are religions that believe one carries things over from one life to the next, kind of like rollover minutes. But I doubt that that's what the disciples had in mind. The idea that sin directly causes suffering is a view that has been perpetuated through the years in many, many segments of the church. And even if this view is not taught directly by the church, the ones who suffer often feel this view projected upon them by fellow Christians who delight in identifying the cause of people's afflictions. And even if we don't perceive this from other people, it's a view that we can hear bubbling up with inside of us. I know that's true for me. You know, in the past few years, you know, I've come to realize that for most of my adult life, I've struggled with some level of depression, and struggled with adequate levels of energy. You know, I've come to realize I'm just a depressive, obsessive, compulsive hypochondriac. And if you don't like it, tough. But, you know, people kid me about this, but it's something that really causes a lot of frustration for me, and at times really bogs me down. And I can hear this voice inside of myself kind of softly saying, you know, what did I do wrong? You know, how did I mess up so bad to have this condition, you know? And I can begin to believe that the sins of my youth, the things that I did in defiance to God, were the things that resulted in this kind of condition. I want to know the answer, see? And that's our question. Is there a correspondence between sin and suffering? And if there is, what is it? You know, was the devastation to New Orleans by Katrina God's punishment on the wickedness of the city? How about if we get cancer or become disabled? What if you lose a loved one? Was that due to sin? Our mind wants to make sense of it all. We want categories and explanations. We want direct causes to the events of our life. And we're really attracted to the idea that sin can cause suffering because we want the corollary to be true. That if I do good, then my life will be blessed and it will go well and I will live a fruitful life. See? That's what we really want. And what does Jesus say to the disciples? Jesus doesn't actually get caught up in the discussion. He doesn't deal with the why question. He just tells us about God. In this case, Jesus says the sin is not the issue. The purpose or result, maybe both, of the man's suffering is for God's glory. So what do we learn from Jesus' response? I think a couple of things. First, we learn that we cannot always explain suffering from the perspective of sin or the events of a person's life. There's not a well-defined cause and effect. What we can say is that in general, all suffering is the result of sin because we live in a fallen world. I mean, that's the way the world is. It's a fallen humanity. And we don't like this. And we'll find out in chapter 11 that Jesus doesn't like it either. This is not the way life was supposed to be. Jesus gets very angry when Lazarus dies, in fact. So we live in a fallen world, and all suffering comes out of a fallen world. We also can say that sometimes we do suffer the direct results of sin. I mean, we can get AIDS if we get involved in an unhealthy relationship, or if we commit a crime, we may well end up in jail. However, there is not necessarily a one-to-one correspondence between sin and suffering. And many times, doing bad things doesn't result it doesn't cause bad results, just as doing good things doesn't cause good results. Some suffering is due to nothing we have done. You know, people get cancer. I'm amazed right now within our church body how many people are suffering with cancer. You know, people do die in automobile accidents. Children are molested. It's horrible. But it's not necessarily the result of somebody's sin. Whether we like it or not, the truth is that there is a great deal of mystery surrounding suffering. And there will always be more that is not known that is known. The second thing that we learn from Jesus' response is that God can use our suffering for His glory. Even though much of the time we don't know what God is doing, we do know that He is doing something. God can take something that is horrible and turn it into an opportunity for His light to shine. In the story, in John chapter 9, Jesus is going to heal this man to glorify God and to make an incredible spiritual statement. But there's other ways that the things that happen to us can glorify God. And since we're on this subject, I just want to mention a couple of these. One is that suffering allows us to share in the sufferings of Christ. We identify with Christ. That's the word in 1 Peter. Don't be surprised, Peter says, at the fiery ordeal coming upon you. But rather rejoice, you know, in joining in the sufferings of Christ, because someday we're going to experience also the glory of Christ. We identify with Jesus. Suffering releases the treasure within us, the resurrection life of Christ. This is what Paul says. We always carry about in our body the dying of Jesus in order so the life of Jesus might be manifested in our bodies. See? There's something incredibly transcendent that happens when suffering hits a person, a Christian. It causes the treasure that's within us to be released, and we become a fragrant aroma to Christ. It doesn't make sense, does it? But it happens. Suffering shapes our character and deepens our relationship with God. You know, this is the word of James, that consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various kind of trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, that you might be perfect, complete, lacking in nothing. Paul even says we should exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance proven character, and proven character hope, and hope does not disappoint. And finally, we can understand that suffering provides the opportunity for love and compassion to be experienced, both from God and from other people. You know, oftentimes, the closest experiences in your life that you will have with God will come in the darkest hours. The times when you are stripped bare, when your life is shattered, when you're on your knees, it seems that is when God draws the nearest. You know, that's the song we just sang during the offertory. Jesus, draw near. And He does. He comes near to us. Oftentimes, it's the closest we come with other people, too. We grow closer to family and friends and fellow Christians, and our hearts touch at a deeper level. There's something that transcends the circumstances. And we experience love and compassion. You know, love and compassion is an incredibly powerful force and gift in the community of God's people. It's amazing. And in fact, it was that force that stimulated evangelism in the early church. You know, evangelism in the early church didn't happen by word of mouth. Fellow Christians were being put to death, and people would see the love in the community, and they would say, this must be real. I'm going to believe in Jesus too. We, that's how I became a Christian. My good friend Steve had become a Christian, and he went through some horrible things in his life, and I watched his life through that, and I saw something different, and I said, wow, this thing is real, because this guy couldn't stand up if he didn't have something inside of him that was beyond this world. We don't know everything about suffering, but we know certain things. We may not know the causes, but we can know the purposes of God. Well, Jesus continues his dialogue to instruct the disciples. And he says in verse 4, we must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. So now Jesus goes on to talk about day and night, and he reiterates his statement about being the light of the world. This connects us to chapter 8, when Jesus made his claim to be the light of the world during the Feast of Tabernacles. It also connects us to chapter 11, where Jesus will once again talk about day and night. And we see that in those verses 9 and 10. If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anybody walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. The question is, when does the night come? Well, it comes when Jesus dies on the cross. And when that happens, the sun sets on Israel. The history of Israel is over. Night has come. Jesus represents day for Israel, and his death brings the night. And so Israel is called to respond while the light is in the world. In the end, Jesus will go out at night. That's always the end of things. After the cross, there will no longer be a distinction between Jew and Gentile. Jerusalem will become a city of the world, and it will be destroyed in 70 AD. Jerusalem becomes a paradigm for the end of the world. Night will come again at the end, at the final judgment, when no one will be able to work. Right now, the world is in darkness, and the church is called to carry on the ministry of Jesus, to be a light to the world while there is time, while it is still day. Now, there's another way of reading verses 3 and 4. The end of verse 3 might actually connect to the end of verse 4. That's possible grammatically. And what Jesus might be saying is that the man's blindness has nothing at all to do with sin, but it is necessary to work the works of the one sending while it is day in order that the works of God might be manifested in him. In other words, Jesus completely ignores the reason for suffering. It's not important. What is important is to do the work of God in the midst of the suffering. Irregardless of the text, the meaning is clear. There's a message here for disciples and for followers of Christ. There's an urgency to work while it is day, to make hay while the sun shines. The blindness is not outside God's control, and he has a purpose in it. When we encounter suffering, all of our analyzing and explaining does not accomplish the work of God. We do not know how suffering came about, but we do know that we are called to bring light and life into the situation. We always want an explanation of God, from God, but what we need is an experience of God. People can be changed. The church is called not to explain suffering, but to change the world by pointing people to the light. You know, I think that's why it does us very little good to try to explain or analyze Hurricane Katrina. You know, it's not up to the church to assess the government's response efficiency. Politicians are there to do that. The church is called to go into the midst of that disaster, to do the works of God, and to bring glory to God. You know, we saw the same thing at work in the lives of Tom and Barb Metzler, our missionaries in Thailand. After the tsunami hit, in the midst of that disaster, we kept getting reports of opportunities for Tom to serve and bear witness, to work while it was day, to bring glory to God. And I think that's what Jesus is talking about in this text. Well, after he said this, he spat on the ground and he made clay of the spittle and he applied the clay to his eyes and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Jesus takes the initiative in verse 6. He spits on the ground, he makes clay, and he applies this muddy mixture to the man's eyes. And we ask, you know, what was the significance in this action? Well, there's several suggestions. It's difficult to know. There was something called a spittle that was to have a healing ability, and that could affect healing. That somebody with authority could use spittle to heal people of physical disabilities. Perhaps it's a reference to the potter and the clay of Jeremiah 18. You know, God is the potter. We are the clay. God takes the clay and he shapes it and forms it in the way that he desires. But the suggestion that I like is the connection that the church fathers saw with Genesis chapter 2, the creation of man. Remember, God took some dust from the ground. And he took that dust and he created a man from that ground. And I think that perhaps is what is happening here is that Jesus is performing an act of creation by using a little dust and a little spit to create new eyes. See? That this is a work of the new creation. And this fits very well with John's gospel, because all over John's gospel there are references to the original creation. And that's how John starts his book out. In the beginning was the Word. And now I'm going to tell you about a new creation. That was the first creation. Now there's going to come another creation. And what Jesus is doing is to point to this new creation. God created light when he spoke his Word. And now God comes as the light of the world to give sight to blind eyes. Jesus tells the man to go to the pool of Siloam and wash his eyes. I mean, that alone would take some faith, wouldn't it? To have to, you know, to get up and make your way down to the pool. The actual pool where this man washed was recently discovered in 2004 when some workers were repairing a sewer line. And it's much grander than anybody ever realized. It's 225 feet long, and there's three tiers of steps that approach the pool on three different sides. The traditional side of this pool at the end of Hezekiah's tunnel is very close by. What's significant about the Pool of Siloam is prominence use at the Feast of Tabernacles that we saw in chapter 7. During that feast, there would be a procession every day down to the pool, take water, carry it up the temple, pour it on the altar. And that's when Jesus said that he was living water. And he redefined that symbol in himself. And now he's using that symbol to heal this man and give sight to his blind eyes. It's also interesting to note that John gives us the meaning of the word Siloam, which means sent, one having been sent, the sent one. Jesus sends the man to the pool of the sent one. The pool is sent by the spring Gihon in the Kidron Valley. And this is a symbol of Jesus, the one who was sent from heaven to be light to the world. The man goes to the pool, he washes his eyes, and he comes back seeing. And the neighbors are astounded. We read in verse 8, "Therefore the neighbors and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, 'Is not this the one who used to sit and beg?' Others were saying, 'This is he.' Still others were saying, 'No, but he is like him.' He kept saying, 'I'm the one. I'm the one. It's me. It's really me.' So they were saying to him, 'How then were your eyes open?' And he answered, 'The man who is called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, "Go to Siloam and wash." So I went away and washed, and I received sight. They said to him, 'Where is he?' And he said, 'I don't know.'" The neighbors are different than the Pharisees. They are so amazed and confused, they're not even sure if it's the same man. They want to know what happened. The blind man knows he's been healed, but he doesn't know where Jesus is to be found. You know, I think this is a common appearance, right? When somebody comes to Christ, or somebody is transformed, really, their life is transformed by the light of Jesus. You know, people say, "You know, who are you? What's happening? Are you the same person? You know, I know you, and I know how you usually react and live, and I know your character qualities, and I see something different about you. Are you the same person? You know, what happened to you?" You know, people are always astounded when Christ takes over somebody's life. I know that was true for me. I knew a girl when I became a Christian in college, and she was completely bewildered, and so much so that she said to me one day, "I miss the old John." And I said, "You know, I don't miss him at all. I'm glad I got rid of him." Well, the concept of suffering creates for us deep confusion and great tension. And the older you get, the more and more you'll encounter suffering. Life doesn't always make sense. It's not fair. And everybody hurts sometimes. But I want you to take away three things this morning. Three thoughts. First, we may not know what causes our suffering, but we do know that God can use our suffering for His glory. Do you believe that? We can expend a great deal of energy looking for answers, explanations, and reasons, but it doesn't get us very far. Jesus sent the man to the pool of the sent one. And that's how we respond. We come to the pool of the sent one, to Jesus, to the light of the world. We look for God's glory to be revealed, and we do the works of God while it is day. Through our tears, we see God is working out His grace and mercy, compassion and salvation. Our illustration this morning of that is Marie, right? Her involvement in children's lives, despite having cancer for the last 7 years. Being a fragrant aroma of Christ, loving, bringing the glory of God into ordinary, everyday events. Changing children's lives. The second thing I want you to take home is that God takes the stuff of this fallen world and He creates anew. That's what God does. God takes our blindness, our brokenness, our weakness, and even our sin, and He applies a little spittle and does a new work of creation. He takes the ordinary dust of our shattered bodies and our shattered dreams, and He speaks light and life into them. He chooses bodies that are disabled and handicapped, physically and emotionally, to become the temple of His very presence. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creature. The old things passed away. Behold, new things have come. We never have to worry about being good enough, or smart enough, or handsome enough, or athletic enough. We are all handicapped. We are all blind. And strangely enough, our place of poverty becomes the place where God works to be His place of beauty. And the last thing I want to leave with you is that in order to see the work of God, we must be healed from spiritual blindness. That's what's required. We're going to talk a lot about this next week as we discuss the rest of the story. But we're blind to the ways of God. And our eyes have to be healed to have spiritual sight. And unless we submit our lives completely and totally to the light of the world, we'll remain in the darkness and we will not be able to see. An incredible illustration of these truths was evident in the short life of Matty Stepanek. Maybe you saw this boy on Oprah Winfrey or Larry King at night. Matty was one of four children. They were all born with a life-threatening neuromuscular disease. All of them died. Matty was the youngest, and he passed away in 2004 at the age of 13. But from a very early age, Matty began to write poems about pain and laughter and peace and God and faith, displaying incredible vision. Let me just read one of these poems that he wrote. He wrote this when he was 11 years old. It's called Opportunity Knocks. He wrote, "I open the door to each new day. I welcome the dawn and I swing open wide the entry portal to each next moment in life. Some days thrust tsunamis with storms and squalls. Some days shower sunshine with laughter and love. some days illustrate the circle of life, highlighting the grass which is always greener on the other side of the hills, where the blossoms grow and the land prospers fruitfully and dreams always come true, or perhaps they don't really stand a chance. As birds announce life through sweet or sad songs of that part of the circle which cannot be seen from this side, I walk with content in the green of my youth. Though shaded with challenges, each darkened or lightened by my choices in vision and views. But I know that if only I open my eyes and I open my life, I open the door to each new day. That's incredible insight. That's a little boy who could see, was given sight by the light of the world. And that's what Jesus wants to do for us. He wants to open our eyes and allow us to see His glorious workings that are taking place even in the midst of our suffering. Let's close.